This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is Nothing Sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and you're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It is now 10 o'clock, and I'm in the studio with James. Hello, James.
Hello, Jim.
And Claire. Hello, Claire.
Hello, Jim. Thanks for the dumplings earlier.
And Steph. Oh, I'm full. And Steph is in Bangkok at a conference, I believe.
Hi.
Lucky. Hi, Steph.
Sure, hi, listening. Steph, if you're streaming. Hopefully she is. And we've got a big show tonight. We've got two guests. But first of all, before we introduce them, let's say thank you to the girls from Her Story for another good lead-in tonight, and also to Leo and Brian for the Sound Museum earlier on new music. And our guests tonight are firstly Esther Anatolitis, who's the Director of Regional Arts Victoria, and I'm pleased to say a very loud mouth when it comes to arts advocacy. I've known her for a few years. She used to lobby me like crazy when I worked in government. So, hello, Esther. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
I hope you don't mind being called a loud mouth.
No, I think it's a great honour.
And we're saying, Esther, she has huge accomplishments, but we did want to shorten it down, so Jim really shortened it down.
Yes, well,
for
I had
us.
To shorten it down from a page full of very, very highfalutin, high art-sounding accolades.
The expurgated highlights.
So this is the expurgated highlight, is that she's a loudmouth. She's involved in so many things. But at the moment, I think she's had a big announcement today. Have you not?
We have. So the next Small Town Transformations is going to happen again. So for those who were involved in or heard about that amazing program where small towns of less than 2,000 people from across the state can apply for $350,000 each to do a really big, visionary, artistic project that will leave a lasting legacy for the whole town. So that's all at smalltowns.rav.net.au.
Great plug. Thank you.
Okay, then, Jackie and Doug, you should have heard that. You should get onto that straight away. And that's a state government program, is it? Not a federal government program.
Yeah, that's right. That's,
we're going to talk a bit about the difference about that tonight.
I think that's an opportunity to do a shout-out to our listeners. If anyone has a town in mind, and even better, an idea in mind, we want you to SMS or message it in. What is it, Jim?
It's 0427-JOY949 on the SMS, or you can email us with a fabulous idea. We'll pass them on to Esther on air at joy.org.au. Tell us what your wonderful idea is, and we might be able to slip it into the in for consideration, or at least slip it to her so that she can send you the application form so that you can apply
and be assessed. At the beginning of November, so it's like got a whole month to just
state.
Get some ideas going, and then get together and
apply. What about those people that have got? You know, there are lots of little arts festivals around the state that struggle every year. Are they eligible to apply for an upgrade?
Well, if they've got an idea for how a festival could transform a whole town, so it's bigger than a festival. It's about something that would involve everyone, that would change the way that people feel about the arts, about participating in the arts, that would encourage a passion for the arts. So it's that really big thinking.
So is it all community-based, or is there a commercial aspect to it? What if somebody came to you and said, I've got an idea to have an arts incubator in this little tiny country town?
Well, yeah, if they could show just what a transformative impact it would have, then that could possibly work. There's some five amazing projects that have already happened in Avoca and Dookie and Natamuck and Neerham South and Oyen, so people can have a look at those on the website and then also
The Natamuck one is pretty spectacular, isn't it?
It is, and And
it's the only town that's growing in its region.
Matamuck is amazing. There is just this really maverick community of mountain climbers and artists, and the Natty Fringe is happening in a few weekends' time, and that's when the whole place will just come alive and multiply its population many, many times. We all head over there and see what local artists and artists
have,
are making.
They have various artists in residence, I believe, at various times of the year, because a friend of mine runs one of those programs.
Mm. Is there an artist hub up there that's quite populated?
It's become a place that attracts people who want to take creative risks. I mean, there's also the risks of just adventuring on Mount Arapiles and other kind of places, but it's attracted people.
Falling off a rock.
climbing the rocks.
Sounds like there could be a cabaret show in there.
Jim, while we've got Esther here, we should ask her some hard questions too about some of them.
Well, we should.
Difficult things that have been going on in
Esther, what I'd really like to ask you is some of the carry-on that went on during the Abbott government time with Senator George Brandis, who was the then Minister for the Arts. And he sliced a fair bit of money off the Australia Council, I believe, didn't he, and transferred it into a new program called the Excellence for the Arts or something like that. What does excellence mean? And why was there an attack on the Australia Council?
Ah, well, two big questions. What does excellence mean? I think that's one that is often talked about and hotly contested in the arts. And the great thing about the way that the Australia Council defines it is that it's not defined. It's something that artists together make judgments on in the way that grants are assessed. So it's that notion of peer assessment. So excellence in the arts is about the way it's recognised by your peers. It's about the way that the work reflects on its tradition, about the rigour that's involved in it, about the recognition that it receives in reviews and so on, about the contribution that it makes to the art form. And so,
well, who better, really, I guess.
And it's kind of, it's one of those, to use that bizarre word, aspirational sort of terms for the way that you would hope to develop your practice and the way that you want to keep engaging with other artists in developing your practice. And so it was kind of strange that the word was taken for that program, the National Program for Excellence in the Arts, because it gives the mistaken impression that the Australia Council was not about excellence, whereas everything the Australia Council was, all the conversations it's been trying to foster for years and years, which are reset every time any group come together to assess any grant,
but
it's all about excellence.
But wasn't it an attempt to transfer money to the elite art sector?
Yeah.
You know, the Australian Opera, the Australian Ballet, etc.
And
the big state theatre companies, the
institutions,
orchestras,
really.
And things like that. Mm.
The explanation that the former minister gave about having this program is that he kept getting, knocks on his door from organisations who weren't getting money from the Australia Council, and therefore there should be another opportunity for them. Mm. But, if you've got a body that's about funding excellence and funding the best, but also supporting the whole ecology of the art, which is what the Australia Council does, and then you've got this argument of, some people aren't getting funded. It's kind of like, knocking on the Australian Institute of Sport's door and saying, I didn't win the race and I'm really disappointed. So, look, and so are my mates. We should totally get some funding. So, that's
Can you imagine what would
really
happen in the science in the science
well,
field?
That's right.
Happened when people came and said, I applied for an ARC grant or an NHNRC grant and I didn't get it because my randomised control trial wasn't considered to be up
and
to scratch, but it's not fair and I want one.
And we've got this understanding that scientists who make those peer decisions are doing it through expertise, and people who work with a range of other professional bodies, CSIRO and so on, are doing it through expertise. But we don't yet have this confident national kind of discussion that should be led by arts ministers, that in fact artists have expertise, and that's what's contributed to the great work of the Australian
Council. So the new Victorian Minister for the Arts is Martin Foley, who we all love on this radio program because he's also the first Australian Minister for Equality.
That's right.
And has he changed the way in which the conversation is going between the arts department bureaucrats and the arts community?
Mm, good question. Where's the forum for it? Yeah,
he's done that in a massive way. So first of all, he's taken on the role of the Minister for Creative Industries, so expanding the arts to understand all the creative practices, be it film or fashion or architecture or games. And then he led this big process to develop a strategy for creative industries. And it was the biggest public consultation, all these forums and ways of getting involved and so on. Just literally asked everyone, you know, what should it be? How should it work? And I was on the expert reference group for that, so had the sort of view from the other side of just seeing the way that everything, all the contributions came together, and it was really heartening. And I guess in contrast, that's what's made the national situation so frustrating, because in the few years before, there was also this national consultation around a national cultural policy. And so you had this great big project of involving experts and artists and audiences from all around the country on what actually supports the arts. And the Australia Council was just at the point this year where it was introducing its new strategic plan. So something that was not just about supporting organisations who'd always been supported, but actually asking the question of how do you support the arts across Australia, and how do you do that really strategically? How do you foster risk and experimentation and all those things? And now all of that has been thwarted.
So the old programs that used to be around, I remember the days of the Keating government, and there were things called the Keatings, which were actually fellowships for the best people in the arts to survive. They were sort of patronage, weren't they? So people could actually have a living wage or a decent living income, and they could undertake an exploration of their own arts practice and create a new artwork of some sort.
Yeah, and this had kind of come back. There was I've just got what they were called, the Australia Council, the Australia Creative Fellowship, something like that. So $100,000 a year. So that it'd sort of gone from entirely project-based and organisational funding to something that was actually about supporting
Imagine if
artists.
Moira Finucane had one of
those.
Oh, my
God. The country would weep with joy. Could you imagine? be weeping with something. I mean, oh my God. But I mean, that's the thing about the Australia Council, though, and what makes this discussion, I think, just so interesting, is that we think of the Australia Council as being the funding body. But the Australia Council is so much more than that. It's when it comes to the arts and the way that it works and policy and stuff, the Australia Council is kind of like the regulator as well. So
it's a developer, isn't it?
It's a developer, it's a policy body, but it's a regulator in the sense that when an issue arises, if it's about, you know, protocols for working with Indigenous artists and telling stories in respectful ways, or working with children, you know, a whole lot of different ways that that artists make and present work, it's the Australia Council that creates the framework where different things can happen. Large organisations can get funded, small organisations can get funded, and thereby fostering this whole ecology.
Yeah, so more of an arbitration type of
Well, not so much arbitration, mediation. But It kind of by doing policy and funding, it kind of creates the playing field, sets parameters.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's where the attack on it is dangerous, because it's disingenuous to say, oh, you know, artists are just concerned about, getting more funding and preserving a status quo. Whereas in fact, it's the way in which we envisage and respect and engage with the arts that the Australia Council is there to foster. And was doing that very differently this year.
Esther, have you had any communication with Mitch Fifield?
Fifield, yeah. We met in Mildura last week. Mm-hmm. I was there for the Mildura Palimpsest Biennale number 10, which is just great. Mm-hmm. And he and every arts minister around the country were there for the meeting of cultural ministers, which is something that happens, I think, like once a year or something. They all get together, have a good chat. And from what I've heard and what has since been reported, this good chat was all about just letting the new Senate, the new minister know really, really clearly just what the impacts of the NPA on the Australia Council and the broader ecology are. And apparently he was just very, very keen to listen and keen to understand some of the big changes.
Well, we might explore some of that in just a minute, because we're going to go to some messages now.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back, Esther, and talk to you more about what that ecology might look like.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 Is Nothing Sacred.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB TIQ Community Radio Station, Joy 94.9.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Joy 94.9 and Is Nothing Sacred, and that was the fabulous Sia with I'm Alive. I played that for my partner, Glenn, who very loyally sits in bed on a Monday night at 10 o'clock and listens and then critiques the show when I come home. So hopefully he was listening to that. And it is now 20 minutes past 10. We're speaking with loudmouth Esther Anatolitis.
And we love her for it.
And we like her for that. And we were talking about the ecology of the arts and where it's going. So with the arts in Victoria being renamed the creative industries, well, not renamed, but sort of formulated as the creative industries, what does that absolutely entail?
Well, it's kind of, it's just a recognition that people who we think of as creative practitioners are doing a whole bunch of different things.
What's the biggest art installation in Melbourne?
You mean by size? The biggest art installation?
By size physically, you know, like, is it the face of William Burrack on that apartment building up the end of Swanston Street, or is it, or is it the Royal Exhibition Buildings, or what is it?
Yeah, well, that speaks to exactly the question that you just asked, because previously, the way that art was funded, architects wouldn't have been considered artists.
Do you know who designed the Royal Exhibition Buildings?
Was it Norman Foster?
No, the Royal Exhibition, those old ones that are World Heritage Site, were designed by the architect father of Dame Nellie Melba.
Oh. I'll just say a special hello to my architect father too while we're here.
Hello, architect father.
Hello, Peter, if you're listening.
Wow, that's amazing. Nellie Melba.
Nellie Melba's father. And if you walk up the street, up Burke Street to Scott's Church, there's a plaque outside Scott's Church that talks all about it, because he was an elder of the Scott's Church. And she never sang there, apparently.
Oh, true.
At either place.
It's all a rumour.
Anyway, there you go. Just a bit of... So that's a fairly big work of art.
Enormous.
I'm sort of trying to get you to say, what is the scope of an art piece?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's
Is the Fringe Festival an art piece or a series of art pieces?
That's exactly the kind of question that needs to remain open for artists. I always thought, you know, as someone who used to run the Melbourne Fringe Festival, I always thought of the entire program, you know, given it's uncurated, as the critical mass of
the year I opened it as an art form in itself.
It was. We'll never forget that. That was wonderful. That was 2008?
It was. With Julia Zamiro and I gave you a brown paper bag stuffed full of something.
That was brilliant.
No one will ever know the contents. Brilliant.
But yeah, when you've got an uncurated festival, then it's the critical mass of everything that artists are making right now, which is the program. So the whole program is offered as a work. And that also answers your question about what is the arts ecology, because the arts ecology is that complex interplay of what artists are making all the time. And so when we think about it from the national level, what constitutes the arts is tens of thousands of individual artists and small companies and organisations doing just all sorts of extraordinary work, pushing boundaries, constantly redefining what art is. Mm. And then there's a small handful of organisations that are well-funded and well-established.
Mm. Which does bring me to another issue in that case. You know, there was a very interesting article in The Guardian that I read last week that Adelaide was the only city in Australia invited to the new international organisation of festival cities. Mm. And whereas, you know, when Melbourne goes on about how it's the centre of festivals, internationally recognised, is Adelaide just sitting across the the border.
It's a very different strategy, though. So Adelaide, like Edinburgh, have got a very sort of destination marketing approach to festivals where they do a critical mass of stuff all at once. And Melbourne, of course, has got a thriving arts scene.
There's only three weekends when there's not a festival in Melbourne.
I doubt there's any.
There's always one bubbling away somewhere.
Yeah. Esther, you were talking before there about, obviously, the huge collection of the artistic community, and that just sort of reminded me that they were in upcry, you know, in outroar, I suppose, at the decision of the previous arts minister to withdraw, I think it was over $100 million of the Australia Council. And just as you said, just as the strategic plan was about to be released, surely there was huge impacts from that decision. What were some of those perhaps negative impacts, and obviously what were the criticisms levelled by the community at that decision?
Oh, massive impact. So $105 million taken out of the budget this year and $100 million taken out of the budget last year. So the Australia Council at the point where if any more money is taken away, it would actually not be able to fulfil the function that it is, you know, constituted to fulfil. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really dire, because for 40 years it's developed a more and more sophisticated strategic approach to fostering the arts. And so the strategic plan that you just mentioned, that was the result of years of work responding to a lot of industry criticism and coming up with something quite responsive and flexible. Mm. And like I was saying about the, you know, huge number of independent artists out there, one thing they were going to do for the broader ecology was to offer 6-year organisational funding for arts companies so that there's that stability from which to take great big risks from. That's now not going to happen at all, and there'll be a 4-year funding program, but it'll support, you know, like a third or more fewer companies, which and so now there's just this, you know, really, really difficult situation.
It's adopting a market economy approach to the arts, which is inapplicable.
Well, it's an austerity model, which is completely uncalled for and unnecessary. What we're actually doing is seeing the slashing, the culling and the contraction of one of Australia's most thriving and energetic and growing industries. It has flow-on effects and, you know, billions of dollars of, you know, economic impact, if you want to look at it that way, at a time where it was, you know, poised to just be absolutely explosive in its impact. So no reason whatsoever. Very disappointing.
Penny pinching.
So obviously, Esther, there's been a huge impact, which is unavoidable from a political point of view. We've had a change of leadership. So we are going to go to a few more messages, but we will have on the line when we get back, we'll have a Jeff McMullen, who's a journalist.
Yeah, it's a former Four Corners.
We will introduce him in a moment. We'd like to have you both on to perhaps talk about the new changes in the Arts Minister and how that may or may not impact the arts community. You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hello, darlings. This is Miriam Margolyes asking you and ordering you to tune in to Joy 94.9, Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station. It's gorgeous.
Thank you, Miriam Margolyes. And we are gorgeous here. And we're gorgeous in the studio with Esther Anatolitis from Regional Arts Victoria. And on the phone, we have Jeff McMullen, who is I was going to call you a doyen. Actually, Jeff, is that too rude?
of anything you like, Jim.
Of political and foreign journalism in Australia. In my view, you're up there with Peter Grester, I've got to say. Mm. But anyway, we've been talking, Jeff, to Esther about the arts and what happened with the almost dismantling of the Australia Council and the slashing of their funding so that they became almost...
A toothless tiger.
Yes, a toothless tiger to a fair bit of it. And Esther's been giving us a bit of a rundown about the difference between what's happened in Victoria, where the arts portfolio has been expanded out to a creative industries portfolio, and there's a different approach by the creative ministry minister here.
We're just sort of thinking, you know, have we observed a change in government or just a change in salesmen? What do you think, Jeff?
I think it is a change in government, but it's early days to see whether in the arts area it will significantly change. The federal trend has been to gather so much power in the Abbott era, with ministers really ruling the distant corners of all kinds of areas of life in Australia. And I think that has been a very unhealthy trend. So when people looked at George Brandis, they could see that he, in fact, was directing funding towards the things that this particular minister thought were the cultural areas that he wanted to support. So I suppose if you were a ballet fan and opera fan, then you might have been encouraged to think that there was going to be a boost for your particular area of the arts. But a lot of the people I know, screenwriters, filmmakers, the hard-working writers who are great in number, but of course work incredibly hard to survive, let alone get that kind of support. I think the cutbacks in those areas, you know, Screen Australia had very savage cuts. So the Australia Council was the bit that I think the media focused on, but it was, in a very short time, a very, I thought, savage message that was sent out that this individual minister was going to make decisions that would affect the whole artistic scene in Australia.
Esther, would you say that, in your opinion on that, would you say that there was an ideological overlay in this potentially? Or obviously it had huge impacts, but would you think that these decisions obviously aren't created in a vacuum? Thoughts? Or Jeff, if Esther can't, then Jeff, your thoughts?
it's very hard to escape that conclusion, and particularly because the whole focus of the Australia Council is to come up with what are the best strategies for encouraging the most exciting work and for encouraging artists to be artists. It's open, it's competitive, it's entirely transparent, you know, to use that word. It's extremely clear how decisions are made, and so to attack that by withdrawing funds, but also to attack it by actually saying that it's not transparent and that its decisions are not clear, that clearly serves a political purpose.
And it's really part of the politics of fear, isn't it?
Well, it's. I would say, Esther and Jim, that it's certainly politics, and every ministerial decision has that edge of politics about it. This was the same minister who made outrageous comments about, you know, that we have the right to be bigots, and his comments on discrimination.
And his attack on Gillian Triggs was pretty horrible. Yes.
Well, that's showing that it was a reach, and I think an interpretation of law and a very gross misreading of even the spirit of this country. I thought that lack of judgment, I wouldn't want someone like that anywhere near the arts portfolio, and I wouldn't want him anywhere near the law in terms of bringing genuine justice to our society. I think, quite frankly, that those were indicators of an ideological man, and the ideology perhaps clouded his judgment and certainly at times impeded on his ability to make fair decisions and to be impartial, whether it was about the issues of discrimination or whether it was about how best the arts can be supported. Certainly, I can't think of a writer that I know or a screen worker or a filmmaker who actually thinks that this recent era has been healthy for artistic production.
And Jeff, that's a huge concern, because there's practical things that are done, and then there's the way in which the change of tone creates the uncertainty which makes artists less likely to want to take those risks. So one of the justifications that was given for the changes was that the minister said that with the growing, you know, kind of firmness and sophistication of the plan that the Australia Council was putting together, that apparently there wasn't much left for the arts minister to do. This was something that the former minister actually said. But of course, what we want an arts minister to do is to attend opening nights. We want them to champion the arts across the nation. We want them to be absolutely passionate about what artists as individuals do, about the role of artistic practice in everyday life, in education, in health and well-being. We want them to know who the great artists are from the small to medium companies who are touring the world and receiving great recognition overseas. That's the role for the arts minister. And then to create the platforms where policy, really great, responsive, useful policy can be developed.
Quality.
That's the telling sign of whether a minister or a prime minister is really contributing to the development of the arts. If you go back, for instance, to the Gorton era, and you see how to have a prime minister and his partner championing the film industry, I mean, it was a threshold that we crossed in that time, and having the support of a prime minister was enormously important.
And even later,
when you see in state governments someone that not only sees it as a responsibility but has a passion for it, the whole quality of what is done is handled in a different way. So it's not a fiefdom, it's just that understanding that there will be incredible diversity, the voices, and the competition to get support is a healthy part of that. You know, it will always be a struggle for any of us who want to write and make films about subjects that perhaps the majority and certainly governments aren't interested in. As an independent filmmaker, that I know that just goes with the patch. But you would like to think that nonetheless there is a process that is fair, and when very significant subjects can be dismissed because of the structural ignoring of parts of the country or even parts of the artistic area, I think then federalism or this, the great white protectors, as I often call these ministers in Canberra, have way too much power, and it would be healthier for them to share it.
Claire here, Jeff, just really interested in what you were saying about Gorton and thinking about, you know, it really takes it takes multiple governments over a prolonged period of time to build up an arts culture as well. And if that's broken, you know, it sort of starts again, doesn't it? I mean, we think about things like, you know, Stormboy or Picnic at Hanging Rock that happened in the 70s under the probably the funding of the Whitlam and then subsequently even Fraser governments, that wouldn't have been possible had that turn not happened. And we're really going in an opposite direction here, aren't we, at the moment?
Well, we are. If the climate that you were describing very astutely discourages younger people from even attempting to tell those stories, to create that kind of art, then you know something is in fact wrong, that it's not only about budget cuts. It's an elitist assumption that a minister or any particular government can really rule and be the arbiters of these things, because in that era that you're talking about, the bursting of talent that came through from that era when there was high-level support for film, almost all of our impressive generation of film directors were struggling at a certain point. I can remember Phil Noyce shuffling around university and lacing two projectors together to show his radical films, and the Bob Ellis's of this world, you know, floating between journalism and wanting to write scripts, and many, many, many others, and the poets especially. And they all, at some point, need the system of support and occasionally patronage. And the Australian Council, while it will never be able to satisfy every artist's belief that what we are doing is going to be, and I'm not speaking of myself here, I'm saying I know many who've been disappointed in not getting that sort of support. But to them, I've always said, you have to write it or make your film or write, compose your music, whatever, like the greatest people do. It's the passion that helps you overcome that that ignoring of genuine talent that is there. But I'm still encouraged. I see enough wonderful, inspirational art around the country in the most, in the smallest remote communities, where I see Aboriginal people making music, extraordinarily talented painters, and writing in ways that 50 years ago they would not have even been considered as worth publishing, and now there's so much work bursting through. That's why government must take notice.
We're going to come back to this discussion in a moment. We're going to go to some messages first, but I want to come back and ask you about the fine line between propaganda and politics.
I'd be happy to talk about that.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Weekdays on Joy 94.9, sharing your passions.
Hi there, Joysters. I hope you are sharing our passion tonight. We've been talking about the arts and politics, and we're going to go on talking about the arts and politics now. It's 14 minutes to 11, so we've only got 14 minutes left. But we'll cram in as much as we can. And we're talking to Esther Anatolitis from Regional Arts Victoria and Jeff McMullen, who's an independent journalist these days, formerly of the ABC's political and foreign correspondence desks. And he's a filmmaker, writer, etc. in his own right. And we're surrounded by people who are in the arts in this room, I have to say. And I want to ask you, Jeff, and you also, Esther, that the line between political propaganda and a minister telling people what they can and can't make in the arts is pretty fine, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and can be quite awkward. So one of the streams of funding in the proposed National Program for Excellence in the Arts is about kind of using the arts for soft diplomacy overseas. So a specific program around doing that.
You mean not offending Muslims?
Well, I mean, it's who knows what exactly that might mean. Obviously, we would want ministers, arts ministers and other ministers who are representing Australia overseas to be looking at who the artists are, who are touring, who are presenting work and introducing them and kind of, you know, using that as part of their cultural mission over there. But to imagine that work is going to be designed and written for that purpose, it's hard to imagine that as being different to propaganda. That is a positive vision of Australia.
Do you think that George
overseas.
Brandis would have ever gone to Mona in Tasmania and seen some of the transgressive art that is shown there in what is the biggest private gallery in the country?
I wonder. Possibly not. The interesting thing about Senator Brandis, though, is that he wanted the portfolio. You know, he chose that. He really wanted to get to know the arts and you know, kind of immerse and work within it. And I guess everyone comes to these things with their own taste as well.
Yeah. I wonder what the implications of this are for community radio.
I wonder what the implications are for community radio with all this funding slashing and burning. Do you think that we're going to be affected?
Well, we're in the communications portfolio, which is surprisingly not also part of the same portfolio that Mitch Fifield administers. Now he's Minister for Communications and the Arts.
It's an interesting combination, isn't it?
So he, it makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, it does make
if you look,
sense.
If you look at the arts as creative industries, and perhaps Turnbull has done that.
Jeff, any opinion you have on the changes there with Mitch Fifield, Senator Mitch Fifield becoming the new arts minister?
I haven't seen enough of him to be certain about what he will change in that area. But listening to Esther, the bigger point I'd make, and it's perhaps to move beyond Brandis, is that we're in an era of government where this shaping of the message and the spin and the disinformation that is quite calculated. When you said the difference between propaganda and politics, there's an awful lot of the agenda that is almost purely spin, where governments now, if they control the message, to use Karl Rove's expression in America, they create a reality. Mm-hmm. And you can really take almost any of the dominating ministers, whether it was in immigration under the Abbott government, and you'll see that that's what they're doing. They are not only shaping the message, in many cases, we, the people, do not have reliable information to shatter that matrix. It's a very artificial process. It is, again, centralized. It comes out of the bunker mentality that some people know what is best for the rest of us in our democracy. And I think that that's an unhealthy trend, and it's up to art and certainly to journalism as well to shatter that matrix, to crack the wall and let light in where we can. But I saw this developing probably 30 years ago in Britain and the United States, where it became quite masterful. The White House, where my own partner worked, I could see the tools that they use and the sophistication of the controlling the messages. It's highly sophisticated, but it can be disturbing if you happen to object to some of these changes that are being really marketed through this kind of disinformation process.
Jeff, what you're describing is nothing short of Orwellian double plus good, double plus good, really. I mean, it's the same sort of system, isn't it?
Which is why we go on using Orwellian terms to try to unpick this and to actually understand what is happening. You now have to read so widely, listen carefully, and you have to somehow have your own filters on to be able to detect what is coming at you when it's plainly not the truth.
That's right.
I mean, we could look back through examples in the area that I work most in, which is about Aboriginal health and education. The constant euphemisms for describing things that are deeply oppressive and discriminatory, but the government will be calling it the Northern Territory Emergency Response or the Stronger Futures legislation, dressing these things up that are discriminatory and in many cases unlawful.
And racist. And yet,
yes, they are marketed with this saccharine and Pollyanna-ish kind of idea that this is going to be better for people who are totally opposed to the tyranny.
And given the huge shift that was announced through the National Program for Excellence in the Arts to announce the name, it was really welcome that there was then a Senate inquiry led by Senator Glenn Lazarus, and with meetings all around the country. There were 2,200 submissions, which was just huge from the arts, you know, all across the board. And that Senate inquiry is due to report in the third week of November, which means that politically, Senator Fifield has got really just a couple of weeks to have the opportunity to set the agenda himself and announce what will be done, what changes will be made. Hopefully, if the NPA does go ahead, that money will be restored to the Australia Council and that rigorously developed strategic plan will be able to go ahead. But if he doesn't take best advantage of these next couple of weeks, then that Senate inquiry will report, and it will be, as we know from all the submissions to date, it's not going to be happy reading.
Mm. And Jeff, can I ask you just one other question about the future of democracy with all these changes? It seems to me that the refusal to comment on operational issues, whether it be on water operations in the boat people area or whether it would be the
West Papua.
The processes of the Australia Council, seems to me to be a prevent ordinary Australians from actually understanding the processes of politics and governance.
Scrambling.
And that's got to be a bad thing for democracy.
It's been a very unhealthy 15 years or so, I would say, from the Howard era. There really has been little change, even if prime ministers have changed and governments have changed. We've been in this era where the message controllers have denied us, the people, the right to know on so many fronts. So We've known that there, yes, there were children and babies in detention. We've known there were women who were suffering abuse in detention. But journalists being barred from those facilities that are really the consequence of Australian government policy
directly
really was an outrage. And the media has done its best. Some brave reporters have tried to find ways through the barbed wire. But it does tell you that it is very unhealthy when Canberra becomes the total arbiter on these other areas of life, which one could say are more life and death, perhaps, than arts funding.
Yeah.
But I think it is significant that the same manipulation occurs across almost all ministries at the federal level.
And that's exactly what this show tries to talk about all the time.
Yeah. Yes. It's been great having you here, Jeff, just to have some of those things reaffirmed and to have you here with Esther at the same time to be hearing the same messages. At least some of us are thinking independently.
And it is now...
We've probably never needed the power of art to actually challenge that status quo. Sometimes it is only the artists who I think will be brave enough and forceful enough, and this certainly the pressure brought to bear before this recent change hopefully will influence the new minister. But as yet, we've got a new government. Everyone is giving the new government a chance to be reasonable, but We should be looking very carefully, not only at what they are saying, but as you've suggested, at what they're doing. Mm.
But well, there's much, much more to talk about, which we're not going to be able to do tonight because we're coming to the end of our show. It's now 4 minutes to 11, and so
might come
we're
out with
really
a song,
going
eh?
To have to say thank you, Jeff, for
thank you.
Talking to us from Sydney, and thank you very much, Esther, for coming into the studio.
Oh, you're welcome.
Much,
nice Esther. To meet you, Jeff.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.